Okay, I'm going to talk about the Eightfold Path today, but specifically about the Eightfold Path in meditation. As some of you know, I go to Leisure World in Seal Beach the first Saturday of each month. We have a club called the Buddhist Club, the Buddhist Circle. It's been going on for like 12 years now. They said I'd only have to go for a short period of time. And 12 years later, I still make the trek out there. And so we've been exploring the Eightfold Path. And we're next month, we're going to be talking about meditation. So I thought I'd work on that today with you. So if you don't know what the Eightfold Path is, or have forgotten the path factors, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And the meditation part is effort, mindfulness, and concentration. So, according to the Eightfold Path, what is right effort? It is to prevent unskillful thoughts from arising, to abandon unskillful thoughts that have already arisen, to develop skillful thoughts that have not yet arisen, and to maintain skillful thoughts that are already there. Now, the question comes up, well, what is a skillful thought? A skillful thought is one that's based in generosity, compassion, and wisdom. What is an unskillful thought? That is one that's based in greed, hatred, and delusion. So as we sit down to meditate, we want to find our thought process and evaluate it and see how skillful or unskillful it is. How many pleasant thoughts? How many unpleasant thoughts? How many thoughts of greed? How many thoughts of generosity? And that's how it all begins. Now, there are two kinds of Buddhist meditation: mindfulness and concentration. What I find interesting about mindfulness, which is often called vipassana or insight meditation, this is the meditation that the Buddha rediscovered. It had been lost to the world. And when he rediscovered it, he realized that it would lead directly to nirvana. And to define nirvana, nirvana is the end of suffering, the end of karma, and the end of all future rebirths. So, what are the characteristics of mindfulness? There are four kinds of mindfulness that we can do: mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of sensations, mindfulness of the mind, and mindfulness of mental objects. I'm going to talk about mindfulness of sensations because that's the easiest and fastest one to talk about. Okay, how many sensations do we have? The Buddha said we have three sensations. He kept it simple. We have pleasant sensations, we have unpleasant sensations, and we have neutral sensations. He said you really don't recognize the neutral sensations. They don't catch your attention. What you do recognize are the uncomfortable sensations, the unpleasant sensations, and the pleasurable sensations. Now, when I started to meditate way back in 1979, I didn't have very many pleasant sensations. Hopefully, your meditation practice is different than mine. I had a lot of uncomfortable sensations in my back, in my knee, in my legs, my ankles hurt, my mind was agitated. I often wondered why I was doing this at all, because it doesn't seem to lead to anything except more suffering, but I continued. If you're lucky enough to have some pleasant sensations, then that sort of stimulates your meditation practice, and you want to do it more rather than less. So here we are, and we have these pleasant and unpleasant sensations. And one of the techniques that I was taught was body scanning, that you start at the top of your head and go to the tip of your toes. And you just go down and up, looking for sensations. And there are plenty to find. And once you find one, then you label it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And you continue. You don't evaluate it. You don't think about it. You don't give it a story. You don't try to resist it. You don't try to accept it. You simply note it and go to the next sensation. And then after 5, 10, 15 minutes of body scanning, you then would go into a state of reflection. And you would see if you could find the three aspects of Buddhist wisdom in any of these sensations. And the three aspects of Buddhist wisdom are impermanence, suffering, and not self. So you look at a sensation and you would say to yourself, is this sensation permanent? And if you think about it long enough, you realize that there was no sensation that you came upon that was permanent. They were always shifting and changing. And then they'd sometimes seem like they'd go away, or sometimes they feel like they got even worse, but they never stayed the same. Then you would say to yourself, well, do all these sensations, were they all, did they all consist of suffering? Did I suffer from every sensation that I experienced? And upon reflection, you would say to yourself, well, you know, there were some really good sensations, so I surely wasn't suffering with those. But if I factored in impermanence, then every sensation became ultimately unsatisfactory because they changed. The good ones changed and became worse, and sometimes the bad ones changed and become better. But they always changed, and ultimately they always led to suffering. Then you would want to say, did any of them have an essence? Did the sensation stand apart from everything else? And you'd have to say, well, no. If I wasn't sitting on the floor like I was, those sensations probably wouldn't have happened. If I had been moving around, I wouldn't have noticed those sensations. And every sensation came about because of something else. They didn't stand independently and apart from me and everything I was doing. And so you'd have to say, well, there wasn't a self or an essence or any kind of separateness in any of these sensations. When that was finished, you then apply those three aspects of Buddhist wisdom to the world around you. And you'd have to say, well, is everything in the world impermanent? Yes. Is everything in the world ultimately going to be filled with suffering? Yes. Even the best situations and the best people have to change and leave us. They either die or change into something else. Is there a self or an essence in anything? And we talk a lot about Buddhist not self. But does the mountain have a self? Does the car have a self? They have an identity. They have a relative self that we can name and use and understand intellectually. But ultimately, no, they don't have their own separate self or identity. You have succeeded now in doing mindfulness meditation from a Buddhist perspective. Now we go into concentration. Concentration was already practiced back in India at the time of the Buddha. Everybody was doing concentration meditation because mindfulness had been lost. And you would say to yourself, well, how did the Buddha learn concentration meditation? Because he rediscovered mindfulness. The yogis of India taught him how to do concentration meditation, which is called samatha. And he was really good at it. He had done it before in many lifetimes, and he was really good at it. And it said that some of the teachers wanted him to take over the students because he was better than the teachers. But he said, no, I'm still looking for the right kind of meditation to end suffering completely. So, what are the aspects of concentration meditation? There were five aspects: applied thought, sustained thought, happiness, bliss, and equanimity. And you go through four stages. This is the simplified version. Bhikkhu Bodhi has a wonderful booklet called The Four Noble Truths and goes into greater detail than I can in the 20 minutes I have to speak. So let's think about applied thought and sustained thought. We sit down, take our position, bring our mind to the sensation of breath. Now, there are many other objects we could use for meditation, but I like the sensation of breath because you always have it with you. And the breath is always happening right now. That sensation of the breath is a now experience. So you would come to the sensation of breath, either the belly or the tip of the nose, and feel the sensation going out and coming in, going out and coming in. And that would be applied thought and sustained thought. Okay, if you do it long enough, if you're focused on that sensation of breath, eventually you don't need to apply the thought any longer. Your thought simply rests on the sensation of breath. So applied thought, sustained thought. Now it sustains itself. There's no effort in sustaining it. You are sitting and your breath becomes you, and you become your breath. And it's going out, and it's coming in. When that happens, we have three other characteristics that arise: happiness, bliss, and equanimity. Now, the happiness is the happiness of the mind, bliss is the bliss of the body, and equanimity is the balance of the mind. So if you get into this calm, focused attention, what happens, it brings an internal happiness to surface. And it just feels good. You found your place in the universe. And there you are, just breath going out and coming in. And there's a certain inner happiness, a tranquility, if you will, that occurs. Then you notice that there is a physical sensation called bliss, which is the counterpart of happiness for the body. So the body has this sort of bliss aspect, and then the mind has this happiness aspect. And you realize that if you want to go further and go to the fifth step, equanimity, you're going to have to let something go. Because those two, happiness and bliss, are blocking your entrance to this equanimity. Now, you reflect on it. And you would say, well, I really don't want to give up my happiness because it feels really good and it takes a long time for it to appear. And why should I do that in the first place? And the answer is because it's dualistic. Happiness always connects to sadness. If you're able to let go of your happiness, you're able to let go of all future sadness as well. Now, the problem is, we can't let go of happiness because we didn't have much to do with it. We created the conditions necessary for it to happen. But we can do something about our attachment to happiness and our aversion to sadness. And when we figure out how to let go of the attachment, happiness falls away. And now we have the physical bliss. And it's the same thing. That prevents you from having equanimity. And now you have to figure out how to get rid of the physical bliss. And why do you want to get rid of the physical bliss? Because the other side is pain. And if I can get rid of the pleasure of the body, I can get rid of the pain of the body as well. And if you're a meditator and have meditated for a while, you know that's a big incentive. It would be so nice to just not have the pain of the body distracting you from your object of meditation. So you practice letting go of the pain and the pleasure, and eventually it falls away temporarily. It's always going to come back as soon as the gong rings and you have to go out the door and drive on the 405. But until then, you don't have it. And now you come to this place of perfect balance of mind, where it's the middle path. There's no pain, there is no pleasure, there is no happiness, there is no sadness. There is simply this aspect that you worked on really hard to get to, and this perfect balance of mind allows you to see the universe in a particular way. Non-judgmental. You have no likes or dislikes. It's a place of total acceptance of the way things are. Now, that mind state can be carried with you temporarily and also arise in certain situations where you'd rather not be there. Say there's a car accident on the corner and you see people, you know, suffering and dying. And if you have equanimity, you can be of great service to those people because you don't have any kind of repulsion, or you're not averse to the situation. You're there to help. You're there to be of service. So this idea of equanimity and being able to take it to certain situations and not make it personal, to simply have something to do and someone to be in that situation. Now, what the Buddha found with this, it was always temporary. He could go into these deep levels of meditation, but then he had to come out of them. And that's why he felt this was not the ultimate goal of meditation. It was a temporary goal of meditation. But when he rediscovered mindfulness meditation, he realized that could end suffering forever. So he taught mindfulness meditation, and a lot of people practiced, and a lot of people succeeded in achieving nirvana, partly because of that kind of meditation. Now, what I found interesting when I was going to the College of Buddhist Studies right across the street for 6 years, that you didn't really hear much about Vipassana from the Mahayana, that the Mahayana tradition sort of emphasizes concentration, and that the Theravada tradition kind of emphasizes mindfulness meditation. And I thought to myself, why would that be the case? Why would one prefer one form over the other? And then it made sense because of the Bodhisattva ideal. There was only one Bodhisattva in Theravada Buddhism, and that was the Buddha before he became the Buddha. But in Mahayana Buddhism, there are a bunch of Bodhisattvas, and they're all out there working hard to reduce the suffering in the world. And if you achieve nirvana, that will be your last lifetime. And so you won't be able to continue helping others with the end of suffering. But if you achieve enlightenment, you can still continue lifetime after lifetime being of service to humankind as well as animal kind too. Okay, so let me give you my definition of enlightenment and my definition of nirvana. Nirvana, as I said before, is the end of suffering, is the end of karma, and the end of all future rebirths. Now, what I found interesting, again, was why did they end karma? What's the point in not having karma? And the point of not having karma is you can't be reborn. Because what's being reborn? Our karmic energy. As long as we have karma, we will find rebirth. But once you end your karma, you can no longer be reborn, and you reside in nirvana after death. Okay, so now we come to the Mahayana and enlightenment. And I define enlightenment as the direct experience of the interconnectedness and interdependence of all phenomena. So I'll say it one more time. the direct experience of the interconnectedness and interdependence of all phenomena, which is perfect if you are following the Bodhisattva path, because you come to this place of direct experience and interconnection and realize they are you and you are them. And if they suffer, you suffer. And if you end their suffering, you're ending your suffering. And if you're ending your suffering, you're ending their suffering, that interconnection. So when you have that direct experience, you realize that is an ultimate truth. Oftentimes, it can't be put into words because words do not describe ultimate truth. They only describe relative truth. And we're lucky we have words, so at least we can have a finger pointing at the truth, even though the finger is never the truth. Okay, so you've had this experience. You're at the beach one night, and the sun is setting, and for some reason, yourself, relative self, sort of falls away, and you become the beach, and you become the sunset, and you become the waves, and you become the seagulls for just a few moments. And then it all goes back to how it was before. You're walking on the beach. But in that one moment, you had that direct experience, which if you are aware and alert to the experience, will change the way you perceive yourself and your relationship to the world around you. So you don't have to be a meditator for 50 years to experience just a bit of enlightenment. It can happen at any time. Most people, when they have that experience, think there's something wrong. Am I coming down with the flu? What happened? You know, because maybe they've never meditated a day in their life. Maybe they've never heard of Buddhism and the way Buddhism describes that experience. It's just an oddity, something that happened. Don't know why, didn't last very long. You're still the same person and off you go to do the next thing. So it's fascinating when you get into this Buddhist meditation and you've got the two kinds of meditation and you have the two major schools of Buddhism. Vajrayana is sort of a mixture of both, but you've got these two major schools and how one emphasizes this and how one emphasizes that. And yet it all works. Not everybody is the same. Everybody needs something unique to their own particular situation. You know, so you got a lot of people who are into Theravada, a lot of people who are into Mahayana, a lot of people who are into Vajrayana, and every one of those, they're all correct. They're all right. That is their truth. And so if you have a meditation practice, keep it up, because it'll benefit you in the long run and oftentimes in the short run as well. So I'm going to stop there and ask if anybody has any questions.